It is Friday, June the 29th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, a Trump-Putin summit looms, and might Syria be on the agenda?
I can't see Russia making a series of concessions to cut back on support for the Assad regime.
European nations meet to deal with the migrant issue.
This is completely uncharted waters for European Union heads of government. The Italians have said they will not sign off on any of the agreements.
The U.S. defense chief is on an Asia tour, plus a bit of music. Yes, indeed, straight ahead. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin have firmed up plans. They'll be meeting in Helsinki next month for a closely watched sit-down that will play out just days after it is likely a tense meeting between Mr. Trump and some of the United States' closest allies at a NATO meeting. The Trump-Putin summit will be on July the 16th against the backdrop of an ongoing special counsel probe here in the U.S. into possible ties between Mr. Trump's presidential campaign and Russian officials. The investigation into Russian election meddling has raised tensions between Moscow and Washington at a time when Mr. Trump has repeatedly said he wants to build a strong personal relationship with President Putin. VOA's David Byrd asked University of Texas at Dallas scholar Paul Diehl what might President Trump gain from this summit and what might Mr. Putin gain.
I think the answers to both of those questions depend in part on whether anything substantive comes out of the meeting. But let's start with assuming that nothing substantive comes out of a meeting except perhaps a joint communique and promise of cooperation. What President Trump, I think, gets then is a sort of further stature on the international stage and with his constituency, that he can be a world leader, that he will talk to our enemies, that he is promoting collaboration and dialogue with other countries in the world. So I think in some sense it's truly a political advantage for him. And in some ways, President Putin gets much of the same thing. He gains legitimacy on the international stage. He demonstrates to his own people and to other countries that despite the invasion of Crimea and Russian behavior in Syria, that it hasn't harmed his ability to take a leading position in the world and to talk to others. Now, if something substantive comes out of it, what they get depends on what that substance is. It's hard for me to think of what the United States would get in a substantive sense out of this meeting. One might get promises from President Putin that the Russians won't meddle in the midterm elections. There might be promises to collaborate or cooperate in fighting ISIS in Syria. But essentially those are promises and ones that have not been fulfilled in the past. What President Putin might get if there's something substantive could be some type of easing of sanctions that the U.S. has placed on Russia. I think there are some analysts who are worried that President Trump will make some other type of unilateral concession to Russia, much like he made in stopping nuclear exercises in Korea for North Korea without getting anything in return. The one that's most frequently mentioned would be U.S. Reducing troops in Poland or somewhere nearer to the Russian border, although one could think of other things as well.
This does come at a time after two things. You mentioned the summit with Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea. It also comes after the president had a sharp disagreement with the other members of the G7 and advocated for Russia to be reinstalled in that group, even though they were disinvited because of the 2014 invasion of Korea, or of Crimea, rather. Does that make it difficult for anything substantive to come out of this?
I think it does, but again, I think there are things within President Trump's power for him to do that don't require the approval of the G7 or may run contrary to NATO preferences, even though the meeting with NATO leaders is going to take place less than a week beforehand. And so I think some of the sanctions that were put in place by the United States or moving U.S. troops around could be done without NATO approval.
This also comes at a time when the death toll continues to rise in Syria, particularly in Daraa province. There have been reports in the past week of Russian aircraft supporting the Assad regime's assault on that area. Do you think that anything substantive about Syria will come out of this, or do you think that it will just be an acknowledgement on Mr. Putin's part that, yes, we are involved and Syria is one of our allies?
Yeah, I can't see Russia making a series of concessions to cut back on support for the Assad regime. There may be promises to have further collaboration in fighting ISIS pockets that are still left in Syria. There may be Russian promises to try and restrain the use of chemical weapons by the Assad regime, but it's very unlikely that Russia is going to pull back or pressure Syria in any way that would undermine Syria's ability to keep winning the war.
This also comes at a time when there is a very heated debate, even today, about Russia's role in the 2016 election. The president tweeted that Russia, that President Putin has assured him that Russia did nothing to change the 2016 election. Yet we still have Special Counsel Mueller's investigation going on. And there's, rumors on the right about a deep state collusion conspiracy to try to discredit President Trump. Is this a win in trouble travel thing for the president, or do you think that this is picked because he wanted to get a summit with President Putin as soon as possible?
I think he's wanted to have a summit with President Putin, and this was something that he'd promised during the campaign. It was a priority during the first year of his presidency, but as other things got in the way, this got pushed back. And so I think, the timing of this and some of the groundwork have been laid, throughout the whole kind of Trump presidency. And I'm not sure making it in July gets him any particular kind of political advantage or has any impact on either the Mueller investigation, disagreements in Congress, and apparently from some of the public opinion polls makes absolutely no difference there.
Dr. Paul Diehl is a leading expert on international conflict and peacekeeping, also a professor at the University of Texas at Dallas. And he was speaking with my colleague David Byrd. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. European Union leaders have emerged from a two-day summit as they considered reforms to address the issue of migration. There have been some sharp divisions there among the bloc's 28 members as they figured out how they should respond. German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who was among the most open to accepting migrants during the height of the crisis, is under a lot of pressure at home from critics who say Germany has been too welcoming. VOA's Lori London asked Paris-based journalist Catherine Feel if the summit proved to be fruitful.
Even worse than no fruitful result, really. This is completely uncharted waters for European Union heads of government. The Italians have said they will not sign off on any of the agreements at the summit meeting until all their concerns are met. Now, of course, the leaders haven't only been talking about migration. They've also been talking about jobs, trade, security, defense. So this is the first time this has happened. The leaders were meant to have had a press conference in the evening. That has been cancelled. They've all got back together. They've had dinner, and now they're trying to cobble something together which would be, if you like, some sort of an interim step which would allow EU heads of government to get out of this cul-de-sac that they're in and find a way to edge towards some sort of consensus on how to deal with this migrant influx sometime before the end of this year. We're not even talking about getting an agreement within the next couple of months.
Are they planning on meeting again later or this week, or are they finished?
They will meet again on Friday. We understand from the French delegation that France has put forward a proposal for these so-called regional disembarkation platforms. Now, these are areas such as controlled centres on EU territory, for example, they could be in Italy, Malta, and Spain, where new arrivals, migrants, would go and have their papers checked. Now, the problem with this is that, yes, some of these governments have said that could possibly work, but others, particularly NGOs, have said, well, be careful here, because we're not even sure that this would be legal. Who would be monitoring these camps? Whose jurisdiction would they be under? You would need to get an agreement from something like the United Nations or the IOM for this. So the idea that a controlled center somewhere in Europe may eventually make its way to the top of the agenda, this would have what the European Union hopes. This would have two positive effects. One, it would deter migrants from coming to Europe. They think that if they have these camps in these frontline states, then the migrants just might not come, because if they don't have freedom of movement to shuffle around Europe, that might be deterrent itself. And also, it might in fact deter traffickers. They might not therefore have as much income from trafficking migrants from Northern Africa to Europe. So those are some of the possibilities. The other issue on the table is whether or not these disembarkation platforms, as they're being called, could actually be set up in North Africa, which would be, if you like, a sort of a virtual wall across North Africa, across the North Africa desert, that would stop migrants there so they wouldn't even get to the Mediterranean.
What happens if they cannot come up with a plan whatsoever?
Well, then Italy and its right-wing populist government would have won the day. They would have taken away from the summit all the publicity. They will have shown to a European public that they are the ones that are championing their cause. What the European Union needs to do is prove to its people that it is intent on securing the outer borders of the European Union. Europe will be safe is the message that the European Union has to give its people. If it cannot give that, then the fear is that voters will then edge again towards right-wing and populist parties, such has been the case in Italy and also in Austria, and then this so-called liberal middle ground will have been lost.
Catherine, I think an interesting point that people haven't really been talking a lot about is that my understanding is that the number of migrants has gone down significantly.
Indeed, it has. So far this year, 40,000 migrants have arrived in the European Union through the various channels across the Mediterranean. Now, you compare that to 2015, when there was more than 1 million arrived in Europe. And then in 2016, there was 1.3 million. So indeed, yes, it's well down from before. But the difference is now that we do have in Europe a lot of governments that have either populist or far-right politicians in government, and they are the ones who are making all of the headlines, who are really making the running on this issue of how to deal with migration into the European Union.
Catherine Field, a Paris-based journalist, she was speaking with VOA's Lori London. Also in the news, on a tour of several Asian nations, U.S. Defense Chief Jim Mattis has reassured South Korea that the United States will remain and maintain its current number of troops on the Korean Peninsula, that number right now about 28,500. Mattis also spent several days in China, where he met with officials, including President Xi Jinping, who said China cannot lose any territory left behind by its ancestors. While not referring to a specific area, it could be a reference to Beijing's territorial claims in the contested South China Sea. The U.S. is alarmed at China's militarization of that region. Professor Emeritus Carl Thayer of the University of New South Wales tells my colleague Victor Beatty, China's assertiveness in the South China Sea is intertwined with other matters in a complicated bilateral relationship.
Xi is not in a position right now to back down or to accommodate American demands because of the ongoing trade war and the talks for cooperation on North Korea. This is the bluster coming from China, but it has to be taken seriously. But in the sense, the U.S. is not asking China to give up its claims to territory, nor is it disputing those. It's really asking or requesting China to stop militarizing those particular features.
What is the U.S. strategy going forward on the South China Sea?
Well, I think it's a work in progress. Secretary Mattis's trip, as we all know, has been the first in 4 years by a U.S. Defense Secretary. And before going there, he made clear that I think that the main object he wanted to listen was to establish a strategic dialogue that was transparent with China. And he certainly has, in public at least, got Xi Jinping to talk about trust and preventing misunderstanding, and that they both value military-to-military relations at a time of tensions. That's good to see where the bilateral mill-to-mill relationships go and talk about these things. But nonetheless, the strategy on the South China Sea, outlined in the U.S. National Security and Defense Strategy, is that the U.S. will lead a coalition of partners and allies to ensure freedom of navigation and to push back against China's predatory behavior and, from the Shangri-La Dialogue, coercion and intimidation. Stepped up freedom of navigation patrols. There's been 7 under the Trump administration, more than double Obama. Most recent involved, not all the previous 6 ones, involved destroyers. The second was a destroyer and a cruiser. And we don't know exactly what they did, but they did naval maneuvers near Woody and Tree Island in the Paracels, that's in the north, Lincoln Island to the east, and Triton Island to the southwest. So that's quite a bit of the Paracels that got in China's face. Further on, the U.S. has maintained a continuous bomber presence. B-52s not only from Guam flying towards the China coast and returning Okinawa and back, but from Diego Garcia overflying the South China Sea, and combat aircraft carrier groups like the current one visiting the Philippines.
That's not going to change the situation on the ground, though, is it?
No, the infrastructure is there on 3 islands, 3-kilometer airstrips, hangars for 24 planes, including nuclear bombers, refuelers, airborne early warning and control craft. But if we take militarization as a spectrum, China has not yet put in warfighting capabilities, although it's put in surface-to-air missiles, anti-ship cruise missiles. The strategy, I think, would be to put enough pressure on China not to militarize by moving from more or less defensive postures, which the U.S. provides rather provocative, into offensive capability. The South China Sea issue must be linked then with North Korea. It must be linked with the Taiwan issue and trade. So something's going to be solved immediately, and it has to be, I think, consistent U.S. pressure once the U.S. has sorted out the priorities. And since North Korea is on the top, I think that has top priority.
Professor Emeritus Carl Thayer, University of New South Wales. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
President Trump's demand for fair trade might yield results in the future, but for now, if you're a ginseng farmer, distributor, or consumer, you'll have to account for the 15% Chinese tariff on your root product in response to the U.S. tariffs on China. Nan Li is with one of China's largest pharmaceutical companies.
We're going to lose some market, and this is going to embolden our competitor, Canadians.
Canada produces 3 times more ginseng than the U.S., though the quality is better in Wisconsin. That U.S. state produces most of the country's ginseng. Farmer Joe Corchain says he's used to fluctuating prices.
I've went years where I've gotten anywhere from $12 to $16. All of a sudden, it was up in the 40s or 50s.
Wisconsin produces $30 million a year in ginseng, but the tariff effects won't be known to farmers there until the roots are harvested in the fall. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. So good to have you with us today. Now it's time for a little something from the world of music. Tracy Chapman is an American singer and songwriter known for her music that touches many genres, including folk, blues rock, pop, and soul. She's a multi-platinum, four-time Grammy Award-winning artist, giving fans exactly what they want with her Grammy-winning Best Rock Song, Give Me One Reason.
You can call me, baby. You can call me anytime. You got to call me.
Chapman released her critically acclaimed debut album, self-titled Tracy Chapman, which became a multi-platinum worldwide hit. Rolling Stone magazine ranked it number 10 on the top 100 albums of the 1980s. She was born in Cleveland, Ohio in 1964 and raised by her mother, who recognized Tracy's love of music and, despite not having much money, bought her daughter a ukulele when she was just 3 years old. Chapman began playing the guitar and writing songs at the age of 8. And in 2015, Tracy Chapman took to the stage with her guitar to sing a song very important to her.
When the night has come and the land is dark, and the moon is the only light we see. No, I won't be afraid. No, I won't be afraid. Just as long as you stand by me.
Is a song originally performed by American singer-songwriter Benny King, written by King, Jerry Lieber, and Mike Stoller. According to King, the title is derived from and was inspired by a spiritual written by Sam Cooke and J.W. Alexander called Stand By Me, Father. Tracy Chapman was raised as a Baptist, attended an Episcopal high school, and graduated from Tufts University with a degree in anthropology and African studies. Always an activist, caring about others and knowing no one should ever be left out in the cold, Tracy's superhit Talkin' 'Bout a Revolution resonates as much today as it did in the 1980s when she wrote it and it took the world by storm.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds. Don't you know, talking about a revolution, it sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution, it sounds. People gonna rise up and get their share. Poor people gonna rise up and take what's theirs.
You know, saw Tracy Chapman in concert once. There was like a 15-minute standing ovation to the song. It was amazing. This is a long time ago, I have to tell you. And there were about 8 or 9 curtain calls at that performance. It's really quite remarkable. Hey, listen, everyone. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Voice of America today for International Edition. Always good to have you here. The latest world news is straight ahead. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Dave Magnus, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a super Friday. Now a bit more from Tracy Chapman. Standing in the welfare line, crying to those of the armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds and finally the tables are starting to turn.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Over the past 5 years, the Feed the Future Nigeria Livelihoods Project has helped pull some of the most vulnerable families in Nigeria out of poverty. This U.S. government foreign assistance program has helped Nigerians improve agricultural production, income generation, nutrition, and sanitation. The $22.6 million program in Nigeria began in 2013 and concluded just last month. Administered by the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, and implemented by Catholic Relief Services, the program initially helped 42,000 poor households in Abuja, Nigeria's capital, Kebbi, and Sokoto states to increase agricultural production, diversify incomes, and improve nutrition. It also provided livelihoods planning skills, adult literacy and numeracy instruction, and cash transfers to the most vulnerable households. In 2017, the program expanded to Adamawa, Borno, and Yobe states, reaching 10,000 more households. This project took a holistic approach to agriculture, to livelihoods, and to social development, said USAID Mission Director Stephen Hagen. It addressed the needs of the extreme poor by improving incomes and reducing vulnerabilities, and in this way serving as a model for efforts to build resilience in rural Nigeria. The USAID program introduced new technology, improving agricultural production and access to input markets such as quality seeds for smallholder farmers. As a result, crop yields doubled for more than 33,000 farmers. The program also helped farmers to reduce post-harvest losses. The activity engaged poor households in the rural economy by providing business skills and financial literacy support, vocational trainings and lending schemes, and safe spaces for adolescent girls. Additionally, more than 2,000 community workers were trained to deliver over 1.5 million counseling and group sessions on nutrition that led to a 22% drop in stunting, 10% drop in wasting, and 53% increase in exclusive breastfeeding rates in targeted locations. A cash transfer component alone helped lift 2,740 households out of poverty. State and local governments have shown positive support towards sustaining the gains from the program. The U.S. is proud to work with its partner Nigeria to improve the lives of the Nigerian people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
from Washington.